be on for another program, I'm sure. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitakhvay and entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The top stories. The Syrian military says its air defenses intercept and shoot down Israeli missiles fired at areas around the capital, Damascus. Iran slams what it calls a selective approach of some European countries to human rights, saying murderers of Iranian people are roaming freely in Europe. Also ahead, the U.S. says it has no preconditions for direct talks with North Korea after Pyongyang confirmed the launch of its most powerful missile since 2017. The Syrian military says its air defenses intercept a barrage of Israeli missiles fired at areas around the capital, Damascus. Syrian media quoted a military source saying that the interception of missiles resulted in some material damage. The source added that the missiles were fired using Lebanese airspace. Still, there is no word from Israel on the latest aerial raid. Israel has ramped up attacks on the Syrian soil in recent months. The regime frequently launches missile attacks inside Syria, despite the Arab countries' repeated calls for action from the UN. The attacks mainly target the Syrian military, as well as resistance fighters battling foreign-backed terrorists. Iran's human rights chief has strongly criticized two French and German rights officials for their calls to release a convicted prisoner in Iran. Qasem Gharibabadi was reacting to a tweet by France's human rights ambassador Delphine Borion, in which she also mentioned the concern of her German counterpart. The Iranian official condemned this as selective, the approach of the two European nations regarding their so-called human rights concerns. Gharibabadi reminded his European colleagues that the perpetrators of attacks by anti-Iran MKO terror group are roaming freely in France and Germany. The MKO group has killed thousands of Iranians in its numerous attacks, particularly in the 80s and 90s. The group, whose leaders are now based in Paris, was designated as a terrorist organization by the U.S. until 2012. We reached out to political commentator Paul Sheldon Foote for his take on the West's double standards with regard to Iran. He says the support of anti-Iran terrorists is mostly financially motivated.
Well, many of the political leaders in Europe and North America receive large sums of contributions from the supporters of the MEK. Some of the Americans I've actually been given first-class airplane trips to Paris, put in the best hotels, and spent a few days there on the condition that they speak in front of cameras praising the MEK. So the corruption is massive. And it's both Democrats and Republicans accepting large amounts of money.
The Yemeni army says it has conducted a fresh retaliatory operation deep inside the United Arab Emirates. In a tweet, spokesman for the army, Yahya Sari, said the details on the operation will be revealed within the next few hours after the operation. Saudi-led warplanes conducted airstrikes on several neighborhoods across the Yemeni capital of Sana'a. The Yemeni operation came amid Israeli President Yitzhak Herzog's visit to the UAE. Israel's intelligence officials have reportedly advised him to immediately leave Abu Dhabi. The Yemeni army had previously struck several targets inside the UAE with drones and ballistic missiles in retaliation for the Saudi-led war, in which the UAE is an active partner. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed since the war began in 2015. We've spoken to political commentator Hussein Al-Bukhaiti about Yemen's retaliatory attacks against the UAE and what impact they may have on the ongoing Saudi-led war.
And I believe the Yemeni army will continue this type of attack against United Arab Emirates and against their main oil infrastructure and airport. I'm sure that United Arab Emirates, to save their economy, to save their reputation around the world, that they are one of the safest, as they say, safe haven for businesses and for company and for investor. If this attack will continue, I'm sure that United Arab Emirates will stop immediately all its operation, and they will declare that they will withdraw from Yemen, and of course they will do so. Otherwise, Yemeni army will continue to target until the liberation of every corner in Yemen.
Iran is urging the international community to do more to remove an inhumane blockade on Yemen and stop the Saudi-led war on the country. Ali Asghar Khoji, a senior advisor to Iran's foreign minister, made the call during talks with the UN Special Envoy for Yemen. Their meeting took place via video conference. The Iranian diplomat expressed concern over a surge in airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition targeting civilians in Yemen. He said Iran will continue efforts to help restore peace in the war-ravaged country. The UN envoy, Hans Grundenberg, elaborated on efforts to facilitate a political solution and end Yemen's blockade that Saudi Arabia imposed in 2015. He stressed the importance of Iran's role in restoring peace in Yemen. Rights activist Masoud Shajere says the UN is powerless in cases where the US and its allies are involved.
The reality is that the United States and Western allies are controlling the United Nations through sort of Security Council and permanent membership and vetoes. So really, as long as United States and its Western allies don't want to do something, then United Nations is totally incompetent of doing anything. That is really a disastrous position that has affected the humanity of man in many occasions. I mean, you know, we are facing disasters like Myanmar, which nothing is being done. What happened in the former Yugoslavia, you know, they dragged their feet until so many people were ethnically cleansed and genocide took place. And here we are seeing, I mean, you're absolutely right. This is not the information that NGOs like us are giving out. This is the source of this information, that people are facing death and destruction, including millions of children, comes from the United Nations itself.
Over a million Saudi citizens in Jeddah are facing forced evictions and demolitions of their houses by their very own government. But Jeddah is not the only place the Saudi government is targeting. Well, there have been similar instances before, most of them in the form of programs initiated by the Saudi Crown Prince.
Jeddah is the second largest city in Saudi Arabia and is home to 4.5 million people.
Since late October, at least a million people in Jeddah have had their lives turned upside down amid a large-scale demolition push by the government. Residents say the demolitions have taken them by surprise and given them little to no room to plan their relocation because it was on short notice. The displacement has caused a housing crisis, with rental prices skyrocketing across the city. In some cases, rents have doubled in a matter of days and many aren't able to afford them. At least 10 neighborhoods have been completely wiped out so far, as work continues in around another 10 areas. The plan targets some 60 districts, mostly located in the city's southern part, and is expected to continue for months. Online footage and satellite images show the wide-scale destruction of entire neighborhoods, which have been turned into dust. In 2020, similar demolitions carried out in the northern Tabuk province made international headlines. Saudi Arabia's Al Huwaitat tribe sent an urgent communication to the United Nations, calling for an investigation into allegations of forced displacement and abuse by Saudi authorities. Their request came after months of alleged harassment, arrests, and abductions by the Saudi forces, apparently due to the tribe's refusal to relocate to facilitate the government's Neom megacity project. Also, Saudi security forces killed an Al Huwaitat tribe member, Abdulrahim Ahmad Mahmoud Al Huwaiti, who was an activist protesting his eviction. He had also denounced the Neom project on several occasions. At least 20,000 members of the tribe now face eviction due to the project, with no information about where they will live in the future.
And they've even destroyed most of the religious monuments of people like the prophet, peace upon him, and his household. So this just bulldozing history and bulldozing tradition is really in their blood. So I'm not that surprised that they're doing this kind of nuclear scale urban renewal, so-called project in Jeddah.
Proposals of forced evictions were introduced as early as 2007, but did not go through for many reasons, including the Saudi government's reluctance to agitate the local population. But Mohammed bin Salman has shown that he nurtures ambitions that are more important than his own people.
The Saudi crown prince's desert dream, Neom, is due to completion in 2025 on Tabuk's Red Sea coast. It's a city designed to attract international investors, but has been subject to scrutiny since it was announced in 2017, with critics calling it wasteful and inefficient in addressing the problems of the Saudi economy, including unemployment and dependence on oil. Currently, over 11% of Saudi citizens are unemployed. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia's oil sector still contributes up to 80% of the country's budget revenues, while 88% of Saudi Arabia's foreign income is from oil exports. Details of the Neom project prompted a flurry of reactions when it was first announced, as people accused Mohammed bin Salman of using extravagant technology to cover up the kingdom's human rights abuses. Ever since bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has ramped up arrests of activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others perceived as political opponents, showing almost zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnations of the crackdown. The destruction of communities on the Neom side follows decades of tensions between the House of Saud and the tribes it has ruled over since the creation of the Saudi state in 1932. Exerting control over the land through construction projects or destruction of some heritage sites have marked this rule. In 2017, the UN condemned the kingdom's forced demolition of the walled city of Awamiya in the eastern Katif region as violating human rights.
North Korea confirms the launch of an intermediate-range ballistic missile believed to be the most powerful one since 2017. The state news agency says the missile was test-fired in a way to ensure the safety of neighboring countries. Meanwhile, the U.S. has dismissed the missile test as part of Pyongyang's increasingly destabilizing program. It also urges North Korea to join direct talks on its nuclear and missile programs, saying Washington would have no preconditions for such meetings. The missile launch was first reported by South Korean and Japanese authorities on Sunday. Analysts and officials say it's the first time a missile of such dimension has been launched since Pyongyang's self-imposed moratorium on tests of nuclear weapons in 2017. From Seoul, our correspondent Frank Smith takes a brief look at what's driven North Korea towards testing longer-range missiles over the past years.
If we dial things back to then, 2017 had a series of exchanges between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and U.S. President, former U.S. President Donald Trump, the two heavily critical of each other, prior to meeting in Singapore for a summit where Kim Jong-un sort of made a promise to the United States that he wouldn't conduct ICBM long-range missile tests or nuclear tests. In exchange, Kim wanted the U.S. to drop its so-called hostile policy toward North Korea. That was an allusion to the sanctions, the U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions that remain in place. While the U.S. says it will meet with North Korea unconditionally, one of the conditions that must remain is those sanctions that prevent North Korea from trading and exchanging goods in the international community and really handicaps North Korea's economy. Without some, you know, movement on suspension of sanctions, it's unlikely negotiations can take place.
Portuguese Prime Minister Antonio Costa's party wins an absolute majority in a snap parliamentary election held on Sunday. Official results show Costa's ruling socialists garnered 117 seats in the 230-seat parliament. That's up from 108 in the outgoing assembly. The main center-right opposition Social Democrats could garner up to 35% of the votes. A far-right Chega party gained but emerged as the third-largest parliamentary force. The voter turnout was said to be a historic low, but the participation was still more than expected given the COVID-19 restrictions. Costa's been in power since 2015 and presided over a period of steady economic growth. Still, Portugal remains Western Europe's poorest country and relies on EU's pandemic recovery funds. Elsewhere, Canada's capital city at a standstill for a second day as truckers joined thousands of demonstrators to protest vaccine mandates. Trucks continue to block the streets near Parliament in Ottawa, with some drivers saying they will not leave until the mandates are overturned. Truckers and protesters have also blocked the Canada-U.S. border crossing in southern Alberta. Authorities are describing the situation as high risk, adding that police resources are fully stretched in dealing with the obstruction. On Saturday, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his family were moved to an undisclosed location in Ottawa out of fears for their safety as a protest was going on. The so-called quote-unquote Freedom Convoy started out as a rally of truckers against vaccine requirements for cross-border drivers. But it soon turned into a general protest against COVID restrictions, including vaccine passports and lockdowns. And that's it with international news. Stay tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makes the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump vowed on Saturday, 29th of January, that Republicans in Congress would launch investigations targeting President Joe Biden and his family if the party retakes either the House or the Senate in this year's midterm elections. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist John Bowden, writing for The Independent. The piece is titled, Trump vows Republicans will retaliate for January 6 probe, investigate Biden if they retake Congress. Former U.S. President Donald Trump vowed on Saturday, 29th of January, that Republicans in Congress would launch investigations targeting President Joe Biden and his family if the party retakes either the House or the Senate in this year's midterm elections. The former president spoke in Texas on Saturday night, 29th of January, as he vowed retaliation for the ongoing investigation being carried out by the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th, as well as the fraud investigation into his company, the Trump Organization, led by New York's Attorney General Letitia James. When Republicans retake Congress, the Biden corruption will be investigated and exposed, Trump told a crowd of his fans, which roared its support in response. Of the House committee, he added later, what the unselect committee is doing, it's a disgrace. His remarks were his second in just a few weeks mentioning the ongoing investigation headed by Letitia James, who earlier this month unveiled the specific allegations of criminal activity her office is investigating. According to court filings, Letitia James's office believes the Trump Organization routinely misrepresented the values of its assets for tax purposes. The former president did not say what specific angle he thought GOP lawmakers would pursue in their hypothetical investigations into President Joe Biden, but he reiterated criticism of Hunter Biden's past work in Ukraine before Joe Biden took office, as well as the Biden family's other various business dealings. He also touted his support for Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, a Republican and loyal Trump supporter, and suggested that he take over the job of New York Attorney General Letitia James. They want to put me in jail, Trump told a booing crowd. This has been going on since I came down the escalator in Trump Tower 6 years ago. Donald Trump then once again faulted New York Attorney General Letitia James for her supposed political agenda centered around targeting him, pointing out her criticism of his business practices during her campaign for office. Letitia James's comments at the time came in response to well-reported accounts of the supposed criminal practices being employed by the Trump Organization, including congressional testimony from Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's former attorney. House Republicans have vowed retaliation against Democrats, specifically in the form of measures to strip specific Democratic House members seen as favorite enemies of the GOP base, like Representatives Adam Schiff and Ilhan Omar, of their committee assignments if they retake power. GOP leaders have yet to make many specific threats about investigating Joe Biden himself, while far-right members of the House GOP caucus have been vowing his impeachment for months. Even if Republicans retake the House this November, the 6th of January committee has several months to complete its investigation, which has already revealed embarrassing and politically damaging insights into the events of the day when Donald Trump's supporters attacked the Capitol on 6th of January 2021. In the months ahead, the committee is expected to continue its investigation, which may escalate into criminal prosecution for allies of the former president just months before Americans are set to decide control of the House and the Senate. Meanwhile, a billionaire Republican donor and Donald Trump's supporter donated the maximum allowed amount to Senator Joe Manchin after the West Virginia Democrat sank Joe Biden's signature domestic spending plan. The Build Back Better plan sought to boost health and social care and to help combat the climate crisis at a price tag of $1.75 trillion. Senator Joe Manchin, one of two key swing votes in the 50-50 Senate, used the Fox News Channel's Sunday interview in December to say he was finally a no on the legislation. The move appeared to surprise President Joe Biden and enrage progressives, but Ken Langan was presumably delighted. The billionaire Republican donor and co-founder of Home Depot, Ken Langan, an author of a 2018 book called I Love Capitalism, had signaled his support for Senator Joe Manchin before the senator made his move on Build Back Better. "I don't see leadership any place in this country. Thank God for Joe Manchin," Ken Langan told CNBC in November. "I'm going to have one of the biggest fundraisers I've ever had for him. He's special, he's precious, and he's a great American."
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region, which affect the governments, organizations, and especially the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of the Subcontinent, we will discuss the conspiracy theory of love jihad, propounded by right-wing Hindu groups against Muslims in India, and how the ban on hijab in Indian schools constitutes a blatant breach of religious freedom. And we shall also take a look at desperate attempts made by the government in Indian-controlled Kashmir to stifle free media and intimidate independent journalists.
The toxic wave of Hindu majoritarianism in India is enabling the world's largest democracy to dangerously slide into anarchy. The invoking of the word jihad by Hindu supremacists to accuse Muslims of spreading COVID-19, of buying Hindu land, and most importantly, of marrying Hindu women has assumed alarming proportions. Love jihad, as it's called, is a vicious conspiracy theory with historical roots that radical Hindu groups in India used to vilify, harass, attack, and even kill Muslims.
The obnoxious conspiracy theory of Islamic expansionism in Hindu-majority India has its roots in the country's pre-independence history. Right-wing Hindu groups have always sought to fuel any imaginary fear that Hindu women face a threat from Muslim men. In today's times, it has come to be defined as love jihad, a viral social media expression used extensively by the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party leaders and activists to stoke communal tensions and polarize voters. At least four Indian states ruled by the BJP, including the country's most populous state, Uttar Pradesh, have passed laws criminalizing the so-called love jihad. This theory claims that Muslim men woo Hindu women into wedlock in order to convert them to Islam. The claim is not backed by evidence as corroborated by India's top federal investigative agency and many court rulings. Most recently, in an incident reported from southwestern Karnataka state in September last year, a Muslim man was cruelly killed over an alleged interfaith relationship. The dismembered body of 24-year-old Arbaz Aftab Mullah was discovered on a stretch of railroad tracks, becoming the latest victim of the so-called love jihad conspiracy theory. The ruling Hindu Nationalist Party in India has been accused of extending overt and covert support to the radical groups targeting Muslim men in the name of love jihad. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's silence, activists say, amounts to either cowardice or complicity.
More than seven decades after independent India's constitution laid the foundation of a secular republic, the country finds itself at crossroads again. The level of religious bigotry in present-day India can be gauged by the fact that for nearly a month, a government college in southwest India has banned Muslim students from attending classes for wearing hijab. The issue has sparked widespread outcry in India and abroad. School authorities say the ban was enforced to maintain uniformity, but Muslim groups denounce it as a blatant violation of their religious freedom.
On a chilly December morning, seven Muslim students were barred from entering their classroom in southwest India's Karnataka state. Their crime was wearing hijab or the Muslim headscarf. Since December the 31st, the girls have been marked absent from their classes, despite them being present in the college every day. While authorities at the Udupi College, apparently under the pressure of the Bharatiya Janata Party government in the state, have been using pressure tactics to coerce them to cave in, the students have maintained a defiant stance. They say that hijab is a part of their identity and faith, and wearing it is a right guaranteed by the Constitution. As a mark of protest, the students have for the past 4 weeks been sitting on the stairs outside their class, photos of which have gone viral on social media. The protesting students have faced humiliation from school authorities and fellow students, as well as from Hindu radicals for their defiance, but they have refused to give up. The incident has drawn anger and outrage across the country, with Muslim groups accusing the college authorities of prejudice against the minority community. At the same time, radical Hindu politicians have told parents that the ban will remain in place.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mrs. Maitreyi Krishnan at the All India Lawyers Association for Justice from Bangalore. First of all, welcome to the program, Mrs. Krishnan. Now, Love Jihad has been described as a vicious conspiracy theory that right-wing Hindu groups in India use to harass and attack Muslims. What's its origin and why has it grabbed headlines in recent years?
Hello, everybody, and thanks, Amin, for having me. When we look at what has been happening insofar as what they call Love Jihad is concerned, this is an attempt to demonize the Muslim community. It is an attempt to to stop any form of actually it is what they're against is love itself, and that's what we have been seeing over the last few years by bringing about this whole language of Love Jihad. One of the main things that they're trying to do is demonize the Muslim community. The other thing that they're doing is to control the freedom of choice, the sexuality of women, and this is something that they've been doing. This is something that they've been speaking of for the last few years, and over a couple of years or so, it's been something that's been talked about a lot more. And one of the things to note is that in Karnataka, there was in fact an investigation that was ordered into it. And the CID in fact found that there's no such thing, and people who are married outside their religion are quite happy. There was an investigation that was done in Kerala, similarly found the same thing. And if you look at the cases that they speak of as so-called love jihad, and this is in fact a term that we shouldn't just also stop using. But if you look at these, if you look at this, what we will see is that these are basically interreligious, interfaith love situation. It's basically couples who married interfaith, which they're giving this name. And this is something that is, and this is a concerted effort to really bring about, to attack this form of, interreligious, interfaith relationships that are taking place, at the same time demonize the Muslim community, and it's part of their whole communal agenda to make villains out of Muslims, which is something that we have been seeing.
And Mrs. Krishnan, do you think this so-called Love Jihad, which has become a viral social media expression, is the creation of the Hindu nationalist BJP government to stoke communal tensions and consolidate its Hindu vote bank?
It is definitely something that has it's a concerted kind of effort that is being made by the BJP government. It is part of the Hindutva agenda. One of the biggest challenges that the BJP government faces is situations where there is fraternity, where there is love, or there are relationships between people belonging to different religions, and this is something that is like it's almost like a challenge to them because it's something that they're so against. It is something that they're so over the last few years they have been using this language to really attack people who are. In these relationships, in any form of interfaith or interreligious relationships. I mean, it's also it's something to note that controlling of female sexuality is something that has also been used to maintain the caste system itself, and that's something that has been noted. And it is through this control that the caste system itself has been maintained. And this is now something that is being used to again villainize Muslims, to stoke communal hatred, and to really control women. And this is definitely something this kind of attack against the most basic right to choose, the most basic right to love, is something that they are doing very, very consciously and in an attempt to stoke communal hatred.
Mr. Krishnan, as you know, a 24-year-old Muslim man in the state of Karnataka recently became the latest victim of this conspiracy theory fueled by the unfounded fear of Islamic expansionism. Now, does this point to India's slide into anarchy?
I think the person you're referring to is a young Muslim man, Arbaz, who was killed after his hands were tied, his body was mutilated, and he was beheaded for having having had a relationship with a Hindu girl. And for that, he was mutilated, beheaded in this manner. And it is something that was that is extremely concerning. And of course, it points towards the points to what is happening in the country at large. But this is something that we have been saying. In 2015, we had Mr. Akhlaq, who was lynched because he had eaten beef. This happened in Uttar Pradesh. And today, we are seeing a rise in these kind of hate crimes from attacks to murders. That is something that is taking place, and this is certainly something that is extremely concerning.
There you have it, Mrs. Krishnan at the All India Lawyers Association for Justice. Thank you for being on the program, Mrs. Krishnan. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Ahmed Khan, an award-winning Indian multimedia journalist, says the rise of Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, BJP, in India has seen interfaith marriages becoming a dangerous political flashpoint. New Delhi-based lawyer Kawalpir Kaur hails the Muslim students who were not allowed to enter their classroom in southwestern Karnataka state for wearing hijab as fighters. Nita Parveen, a Kerala-based student activist, slams the decision to ban hijab-wearing Muslim students, says it happens when violence against Muslims is normalized and Islamophobia becomes law.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Classic case of silencing the messenger and muzzling the voice of free media, a group of pro-government journalists in Indian-controlled Kashmir on January 15th seized the region's only independent press club with the assistance of armed policemen. The state-sponsored takeover of the Kashmir Press Club in broad daylight was denounced by leading journalist bodies and political parties in Kashmir. Stung by a massive outcry, the government later declared the press club defunct, much to the chagrin of journalists.
On January the 15th, as the New Delhi-backed administration in Kashmir had announced the weekend lockdown over the surge in COVID-19 cases, a group of government-backed journalists appeared at the Kashmir Press Club in the region's summer capital, Srinagar. What was widely described as forcible and illegal takeover of the independent media body with 300 journalists as members was a move choreographed by the government, which evoked widespread condemnation. The region's former chief minister, Omar Abdullah, called it a state-sponsored coup. The Editors Guild of India said it was aghast at the manner in which the office and the management of Kashmir Press Club was forcibly taken over and accused the state of being brazenly complicit in this coup. Days after the takeover, the government declared that the only media club in Kashmir had ceased to exist. The largest body of independent journalists in Indian-controlled Kashmir, the club was founded amid much fanfare in 2018. Following the abrogation of Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in 2019, the club was asked to register again as a society. The process encountered multiple hurdles, eventually ending in its overthrow. As one senior club official noted, the only platform that raised the voice against frequent harassment of journalists in Kashmir has now been shut, deregistered, and dispossessed.
The state-backed takeover and the subsequent overthrow of the Kashmir Press Club followed a string of incidents in which local Kashmiri journalists were threatened, harassed, and detained by state agencies on unsubstantiated charges. In a latest case on January 16th, a young Kashmiri journalist, Sajjad Gul, was booked under a draconian law for sharing a video of a Kashmiri family chanting anti-India slogans after their kin was killed by Indian forces. He is not the only one, and certainly not the last.
Since the Hindu nationalist BJP government in New Delhi revoked Indian-controlled Kashmir's special status in August 2019, the crackdown on local Kashmiri journalists and independent media groups has intensified. Journalists who have dared to report critically about New Delhi's controversial measures, including the attempts to change the Muslim-majority region's demography, have faced harassment, intimidation, and even imprisonment. Independent journalists in Kashmir continue to walk the tightrope. Dozens of journalists have been subjected to police raids or interrogation or being put on no-fly lists. Some continue to languish behind bars, and many others face serious criminal charges. The crackdown intensified after the government in June 2020 launched a new media policy that authorized the administration to prosecute those spreading fake news. This law has been used as a pretext to muzzle the voice of independent media in the disputed Himalayan region, believe experts. Sajjad Gul's case is a perfect example of how a draconian law like the Public Safety Act has been abused to target journalists for doing their work. The Editors Guild of India says the space for media freedom and civil society is fading in the region. It lists several cases of detention of journalists, including that of Sajjad Gul, Kamran Yusuf, Pirzada Ashiq, Masrat Zahra, Fahad Shah, the killing of senior journalist Shujaat Bukhari.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Sanjay Kapoor, the General Secretary of Editors Guild of India. Now, Mr. Kapoor, welcome to the program. What does the takeover and the subsequent overthrow of Kashmir's largest body of independent journalists mean for journalism in the region, and do you see it as an attempt to silence the messenger?
Thank you so much for inviting me to speak on your channel. This is rather distressing what has really happened in Srinagar. Although Srinagar never surprises you, Kashmir never surprises you, because the kind of horror story that keep on emanating from there, not from the last 7 years, but much longer, ever since, you know, the democracy was stifled and the rule of the gun started dictating terms in that valley. It has been like this. You have journalists who are, being pressured and pushed from two sides, one from the side of the extremists and the other side from the government. So there is not really exactly the freedom of expression or speech that you can really think of. And what has really happened is one more episode of the same saga which has been unfolding for quite a while. So closure of the press club is a phenomenon which we had never heard before. And the fact that it has happened and the authorities have managed to get away with it suggests that such episodes, such happenings can take place anytime, anywhere. There is a point of view which the government authorities have also been presenting for a while. They said that you had all kinds of people who had become members of the press club. They were not journalists, and that allowed a point of view to disseminate from press club, that ideas which are not normally reserved for the media were flowing out of it. They were hinting at the extremists who were using the platform, the press club, to pretty much spread anything they wanted to. But that's not true, because the manner in which the government has intervened, they could have avoided that situation. They could have allowed the two factions within the press club to manage their own affairs. They could have done things in a manner which should have ensured that the government hand is not visible. In this case, the high-handedness of the authorities is so much there that they have not only taken control of the club, they have even taken control of the property. And yesterday or day before, I was seeing the social media that the big hoarding which was put on top of the press club, suggesting it was a Srinagar press club, that was also withdrawn. So they don't want to have any evidence of the fact that this building used to hold the press club, which not only just provide people to come and converse with each other, but also provided a place where journalists could come and work, because Srinagar has been very difficult of late with the where reporting is concerned. Internet shutdown is a very routine thing, so the journalists would come here and find ways to somehow send out the reports. But now this club has gone away. I think one of the places where they used to get support, that has also gone away.
Mr. Kapoor, many national-level media bodies and political parties denounced the move they claimed was backed by the state. So why is the government so afraid of free media in Kashmir?
Government is afraid of free media, not from now, but as I said, there is a past, there's a history to it. It's in a conflict area where you have Pakistan on the other side laying claims on the land for quite a while. This is a legacy of 1947 partition. They think that because it's a majority area of minorities of the Muslims, they are the rightful owner of the land. And there are always competing views that you hear. You have the Indian government and the nationalists who continue to suggest that the point of view which is peddled more or which is accepted more by the Muslims of the valley comes from Pakistan. So in a certain way, the government disputes any point of view coming in from independent media because they think it is flowing in from the neighboring country. So that is why, as I said earlier, the journalists are torn between the two. I mean, there is a feeling that the Indian government is working at cross purposes. They are not really interested in ensuring the democracy in the place because they fear that will be hijacked by elements and people who are not in favor of the state. So time and again, you have the assemblies which have been, they have been thrown out by the center. That was many, many years ago. Subsequent to that, you had elections which did not get any kind of participation. And now you have a situation where the government of India has done away with the state as such. I mean, the Jammu and Kashmir used to be a combined state, but after August 5th, 2019, the very nature of the state has changed. Although the Home Minister Amit Shah is saying that he will restore the state, but nothing like that is happening. So in a certain way, freedom of free media is something that the government is not even very clear what it would be, because anybody who disputes the narrative is the one that they would distrust most. And at the moment, the government narrative is not acceptable till the time it is forced out.
Mr. Kapoor, as you know, the takeover of the Kashmir Press Club followed many incidents in which local journalists were harassed and detained by government forces. Now, are these strong-arm tactics aimed at controlling the media?
I mean, let's face it, in Kashmir, it's a police state. And democracy deficit has been taking place in practically most of society. There is very little space for free media in many societies which used to swear by democracy, and worse so when you have a conflict situation. So journalists have been picked up. There's so many who have been picked up just for tweeting. Tweet, if you do, has become the enemy of the state as such. If you say something that goes contrary to the point of view represented by the government, then you are being anti-national, and that is the fear that many of us actually experience even in day-to-day life, because you don't know what is the band of the narrative that we can play with. And this has happened in Kashmir more so because that's an area where the government is very, very keen that nothing should get out which goes contrary to the message that they want, and that is where a lot of these journalists end up being on the wrong side of law.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Kapoor, the General Secretary of Editors Guild of India, for his precious time and insight. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Senior Kashmiri journalist Pirzada Ashraf calls it sad and painful to see Kashmir's only independent press club being sealed. Says it functioned even at the peak of political unrest and the COVID-19 pandemic. Salman Nizami, a Congress party leader, says the armed takeover of Kashmir Press Club undermines institutions and reduces press freedom to a joke in the conflict-marred region. Pro-freedom Kashmiri leader Masroor Ansari cites a news report to assert that journalists in Kashmir have contended with various threats, but their situation has gotten dramatically worse since 2019.
And that was our episode about the rising tide of Islamophobia in BJP-ruled India and also the attempts to throttle the freedom of press in Indian-controlled Kashmir. Thank you for your time, everyone. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
The limelight.
Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has spent much of the past fortnight calling and meeting his MPs to persuade them to stick with him, as the row about lockdown-busting parties has grown. We now present you an article written jointly by Toby Helm and Mark Townsend. The piece is titled, UK Conservatives Charged with Levelling Up Stunt to Save Boris Johnson's Job. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Observer.